So the purpose of today's lecture is to start putting some numbers, attach some formula to the pictures that we drew on the board. In particular, I would like to explain how a picture like this could be converted into an actual amplitude. So if you give me some surface, some topology in space-time, which is, it describes the process of some strings coming together, interacting, and going out, how do I get a number, the quantum mechanical amplitude for that to happen? Now, a lot of the steps that go from here to here might look quite obscure at first. And unfamiliar, because they don't look at all like what you've been seeing in quantum field theory. So in order to dispel that mystery, I would like to first do the same calculation in quantum field theory. So I would like to explain how to relate some diagram like this, which describes some particles propagating in space-time, interacting and going out, how to relate that to a standard Feynman diagram amplitude, something you could find in quantum field theory associated with Feynman diagram gamma. Now, recall that if you have a classical relativistic particle moving in space-time, along some trajectory described by some position as a function of proper time, the action, the classical action for a single particle, is written as the mass times the length of the space-time trajectory. Did you encounter this fact at all? Okay, good. That is a nice fact. And then, of course, you can write this more explicit in terms of the trajectory. In the following manner. So, similarly, if I present you with this process in space-time, I would say that it has a classical action, which would be just a sum over edges, of the mass of the particle that propagates along that edge, times the length of that edge in space-time. So this would be the action which you could assign to a specific embedding of your graph in space-time. Okay? So if you give me one way to embed this graph in space-time, let me denote it like that, then I would associate with a classical action by checking what is the length of each edge in space-time and adding them up. So, at least morally speaking, you would expect that the amplitude, quantum mechanical amplitude associated to this graph, should be the result of a path integral based on this classical action. So some kind of an integral over all the ways to embed gamma into space-time of e to the classical action, maybe I over h bar, times the classical action of this embedding. This would be reasonable. And my objective is to show to you that this formula, at least in a moral sense, does indeed compute Feynman diagrams. And I'll go backwards. I will start from the Feynman diagram and move back towards an expression like this. Now, with this path integral, I just essentially did a bit schematic. What they actually mean is a path integral over all possible choices of paths for each edge. So it was something like a product over edges. Of the path integral for each edge. Okay? I put this in inverted commas because it's a moral formula more than a natural formula, but you see what I mean. So now, suppose that all the particles are just scalar fields for simplicity. I will discuss fermions in a couple weeks. So how does the Feynman diagram look like? Well, momentum space, I have an integral over the momenta in the internal edges. I have a momentum conservation at each vertex. Let me set it. We call space time demands 1,1. Anyway. Then I have a bunch of propagators. Maybe I should have put them here. And then I have. I think that's it. Okay. Then, of course, you put some couplings at each vertex. Let me ignore that for now. Right, let me see. Am I forgetting something? I don't think so. No. Okay. So. Let me rewrite this in position space. The first thing I can do is to rewrite this momentum conservation at the vertices as a Fourier transform, as an integral over the position of the vertices. Here I'm summing all the momentas that are coming out of this vertex. Okay. Next, I'm going to use something called Zwinger parametrization to rewrite the propagators in a more useful form. So remember that if you have the integral of e to the I A L DL as L goes to zero to infinity. Sorry, I don't think you need the I. This is the same as 1/A. So I'm gonna rewrite this in the following form. Okay. Now, at this stage, the integral over moment is Gaussian, so I can just execute it. I will still have a contribution from external edges here. J. Times the position where that edge arrives. And then the Gaussian integral over the momenta can be done just by completing the squares. And it looks like a sum, a product over, may write as a pair of vertices which define an internal edge. Of e to the minus okay. So I hope, is this formula clear? Do you have any questions about the formula or the derivation?
When you talk about edges, do you mean like there's a string and it's bound?
No, I'm talking about tactus. It's all about tactus.
So what's an edge?
A line? At a graph. An edge of a graph is a line joining two vertices of the graph. For example, in this graph, I would have vertices 1, 2, 3, 4. I would have internal momenta P12, P23, P34, P14, and maybe some external momenta P2, P3, P1, P4. Okay. So for that particular graph, this will be an integral over four edge lengths, L12, L23, L34, and L14, over four positions of vertices. Over, there will be four factors of wave functions of external lines. And then there will be a product of the four internal edges of this expression. Which is essentially the amplitude, it's kind of a propagator in position space.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm confused about where the LABs came from.
The LABs were introduced at this stage to rewrite the propagator.
Yeah, the LIs, that's okay, so yes, the dummy variable.
That's right, sorry. Yeah. I here was running over internal edges. And here I switched notation to this. On the note, my notations are a bit more self-consistent. At some point here, I started denoting the internal edges by the pair of vertices they join. Okay, you can surely use better notations here, but I hope that the meaning of the formula is clear. Now, I'm not done yet, but I wonder if you can recognize this expression as having seen somewhere else. This is the Green's function for a Schrodinger equation. Yes?
So you had integrals over B, did you integrate them out or not?
Yes, the internal momenta integrated away. Yes.
So those, like, you have two PIs, and some of them are external and some are
external. That's right.
Okay. It's confusing.
Sorry, this is a J. I can put an external here.
Okay.
That helps.
Yeah.
Okay. So, let me just say now, in the expanding further this little gadget here. And they're saying this is what you would find as the Green's function of Schrodinger equation, which means an expression like this. Can be written as a path integral over paths that go from XA to XB in proper time L with an action e to the minus integral in the tau x dot square plus m squared. Okay. Okay. Maybe I should really give a name to this path so I don't confuse them with other paths. Okay. So, I invite you to do this path integral. It's a Gaussian path integral. It's not terribly difficult. It's essentially done by a subtle point. Essentially, you find a classical solution that goes from here to here in time L. You plug it in here, and you get that. There are probably some one-halves the time. I suspect probably if I'd done things properly, I would have had a one half here and one half here, and one half here, one half here. But you can do it just by redefining L. Okay, so let me. Mm-hmm. So actually, let me do that. Okay, we're almost there. So this is now, if I plug this in here, right, I get a path integral over all the ways to embed the edge in space-time, path integral over the proper length of proper time, and then this path integral over the position of the vertices. This is starting to look like a path integral over all possible ways to embed this graph in space-time. Except the action is not quite yet this, right? There is no square root here, which is good because we can make sense of things without square root. I think a path integral with a square root would have been more confusing. But still, I would like to explain why these, how to bring this even closer to this form. So the point is that when we write this action, we've picked a very specific definition of proper time. And then we use that to embed the graph in space-time. But if I want to think about a graph in space-time, perhaps it's not so natural to decide what a proper time is. Perhaps I might want to consider just an integral over the actual trajectory followed in space-time, not how the trajectory is parameterized. So let's try to sort of understand a bit better what this choice of proper time means, as opposed to the choice of as opposed to some other choice. So from now on, I'll essentially just look at the classical action. Because I'm going to do manipulations which really don't make full sense in the pattern table. But some of them do. The first, what I'm doing now still does make sense. So suppose I take my proper time and rewrite it in terms of some other parameter. Okay? Then this action is not invariant. How does it change? Well, the action becomes an integral in the u of the tau over the u m squared and the tau over the u inverse dx over, I'm writing too small probably, right? Sorry. So this is the action after a change of coordinates. Right here is just the Jacobian. Here I get the Jacobian, but here I also get two powers to the inverse Jacobian to rewrite x dot squared. So this is the answer. Now this action definitely is not invariant under change of coordinates. We can make an action that is invariant under change of coordinates if you keep track of a metric on the not in space-time, but on the word line. So let me define a metric on the word line. So this proper time is essentially a proper time where the metric is 1. It's a proper time that really measures the length along the curve. Perhaps you want to relax that and just use a more generic metric and a more generic coordinate. If this was equal to the tau squared, then you see that E is just the tau over the U. So I can rewrite this in this form. So now I have an action that depends both on the embedding in space-time and on the choice of metric, but at least is now a reparametrization invariant. The way to think about it is that I added a new degree of freedom, which is this metric, but I also added a symmetry, a gauge symmetry, which cancels it almost completely. I say almost completely because the integral from 0 to L the tau equals the integral from the beginning to the end of U, which says are 0 and 1 of conventions, of E of U du. But this is the length. So the metric contains a lot of degrees of freedom. One of them is gauge invariant, the total length. And most of the others are just gauge freedoms, meaning that if I decide to pick a different coordinate, then I'll have a new metric, which is just something like that. So I have this action, I have these symmetries. X of u goes to x of x of u prime goes to f of u, and e of u prime goes to f prime of u, e of u. So I replace this action with an action that extra gives freedom, and engage symmetry. The degree of freedom and the gauge symmetry almost completely cancel each other, except for the total length. So that allows me to write down, still in a reasonably acceptable way, this path integral as a path integral over functions of U and matrix divided by changes of parametrization, coordinate changes, which are called diffeomorphisms, of E to this S of X and E. I don't reach far. But it seems that I keep forgetting the I of reach bar. So. Okay. So now this is the almost the final rewriting. The final step is to observe that this, that if you take this as a classical action, the matrix enters with no derivatives. So it's natural to just solve for the equations of motion. The equations of motion for the matrix tell you that dx over du squared equal to m squared e squared. So you can solve for the matrix. If you solve for the matrix, so solve for the matrix and eliminate it, then the action becomes square root of dx over du squared. So this classical action is not something we can quantize easily. Square root of square, you know, putting square roots in your path integral is not something that you can deal with naturally. But also this action had both, had two problems, had a square root and also had a diffeomorphism invariance, which is beautiful, but is also, it means that there is a gauge symmetry you need to learn how to deal with. You go to this other classical action, which sort of integrates in an extra degree of freedom, but at least makes things quadratic in the fields. And furthermore, this extra degree of freedom can now be canceled out against the gauge freedom. There is a very natural gauge fixing, which is to go to coordinate where the metric is constant. And then you get to something which is meaningful. And then you get your Fermat diagram. So starting from this picture, you can get Fermat diagrams. And you're literally integrating over all the possible ways of embed this graph in space-time with this action. Any questions?
Embedding metric, how did that turn into the integral over all embeddings?
Which one, sorry?
How did metric, which is divided by the diffeomorphisms, became?
Well, if I could allow myself to integrate out E in the path integral, which I probably cannot, I would say, okay, I do this, I replace the extremum value of E in here, and this becomes the usual action for a relativistic particle in the square root of x dot squared.
How do you know that?
Sorry?
You just said if I perform that integral, which I probably can't, then I'm going to get that.
Yeah, I'm saying class, going from, so this was a classical action, which quantum mechanically makes little sense.
Yes.
This classical action can be replaced by this classical action, which makes much more sense. Because it's quadratic in these variables. It's not quadratic in the metric, but the metric can be gauged away using the diffeomorphism variance. And so this is something you can make sense of. So what I'm saying is that this amplitude here can be written as, so how do you integrate over all possible ways to embed this graph into space-time? Well, first of all, you do an integral over for the position of the vertices. And then you do path integrals. Over all possible ways to embed an edge with endpoints on those vertices using this action. Then gauge fixed in the metric way, and doing the integral doing this path integral brings you to the Feynman diagrams. Okay. What do you mean possible? Sorry. This is rather explicit expression, right?
Well, I mean, it's not like I can calculate that thing.
Well, the only subtlety is how to divide by the diffeomorphism invariants. For now, I'm suggesting to it just by gauge fixing. Because doing it properly would require a little bit of work using BRST technology. But you know, there is a very simple gauge fixing condition, which is to say, I pick a coordinate where the metric is 1. Okay. Then this path integral over metric over diffeomorphisms is the same as just the integral over the total length of the line, because it's the only part of the metric which you cannot gauge fix away. So I'm saying replace this with an integral over the lengths, set the metric to 1, and this becomes literally this, where this is written like that. There are supposed to be no mysterious steps on the board. But there are a bit more details in the note, and I can also answer the questions perhaps after the lecture.
I'll just take it for that first.
Because now what I want to do in the remaining almost half an hour is to repeat all of these steps backwards for a surface. Instead of a graph, I want to use a surface. So the classical action for a surface is just the area of the surface. So I put something in front, something that is analogous to the mass, which is called tension. And then perhaps let me know. So the area element on the surface can be computed with a little bit of geometry. Okay. But then you, if you want to measure the area of a surface embedded in space-time, you take the metric of space-time, you pull it back, you use it to define a metric on the surface, and then you take the volume element for that metric, and you integrate it over the surface. Now, again, this is an action we cannot really make sense of quantum mechanically because it's non-polynomial, square roots, and stuff like that. So we need to find some way to rewrite it, which is analogous to this.
Is it possible for the tension to not be constant?
Yes, although notice that you can sort of absorb it into the metric of. But do you want it to be something that is not constant on the worksheet, or something that is not constant in space-time?
In space-time.
In space-time. Okay, then you could just say that you make the metric, you change, you know, you put an overall function in front of your metric. Notice this action makes sense when the metric is not flat. So I could write the same action where this is a function of x mu and x nu. And we will do it in a few days. For now, for simplicity and taking space time to be flat. But later on, we'll ask, how can we modify this action? Can we put a metric here? What else can we put? Okay. So now Polyakov, so this action is called the Nambu-Goto action. Polyakov proposed an alternative action, which is analogous to this, which has some extra degrees of freedom, which can be integrated away to give back this action. Notice this action also has the diffeomorphism invariant, meaning if you do a change of coordinates, where you, no, I'm not supposed to write on that, sorry. Blender. So, if you write U1 as some function of some other coordinates, and you choose some function of some other coordinates, then this changes by the square root of the determinant, so by the determinant of the Jacobian. Right. So the U1, the U2 equals the V1, the V2 determinant of the UA over the VB. Okay. This is the fact of the. This is a basic fact about integration. But also, dx mu over d ua is dx mu, these are partial derivatives, over dvb, dvb over the ua. Notice I'm always using Einstein conventions when there are repeated indices up and down and summing over them. That means that if you take this expression, this can be written with a bit of patience. As the induced matrix from before times a Jacobian. Now, if you take the determinant to the left hand side, because this is matrix product, you get the determinant to the right hand side times the square of the determinant of these matrices. So determinant of these equals determinant over A and B equals the determinant over C and D of these times the determinant of the V over the U squared. Which means when you plug, when you do the change of coordinate in this formula, the determinant squared comes out to the square root and cancels the Jacobian. So this is the homomorphism invariant. Okay, well, it doesn't depend on your choice of coordinates on the worksheet. Which is kind of useful because if you're trying to define the action on a worksheet, which is a complicated topology, you definitely need to be able to cut it down into patches that look like and glue them together by coordinate transformations. So the way you define a manifold is by having a bunch of patches with coordinate systems and coordinate changes from a patch to the other. So if you want to define an action over the whole worksheet, you better have invariants under changes of coordinates. Now, the Polyakov action looks as follows. It's an action for the same field X mu and for a metric on the worksheet, not on space-time, on the worksheet. And the action is just what you would expect, meaning that is the action for some natural quadratic action on the worksheet. This action is again the homomorphism invariant. But you need to transform the metric appropriately. When you do a coordinate transformation. So the Polyakov action is quadratic in the variables you care about, which are the ones that tell you how you are embedded in space-time. Now, it's a non-trivial exercise to show that if you extremize this with respect to the metric, you'll go back here. Although, honestly, if you start from something in homomorphism invariance and you extremize it, you're going to get something which is still the homomorphism invariant. There are not many other things you can find besides that. So it's not such a big mystery. But it's a calculation. If you've done some general relativity, you have all the tools that you need. You just need to vary this with respect to the metric with lower indices. Right. Remember, I'm using the same conventions as in general relativity. So for example, H upper AB is the inverse of the metric with lower indices. I don't really know how to write it properly. Anyway. Let me write it better. HAB, HBC equal to delta AC. And H means determinant of HAB. Okay? So these are standard notations. So now if you need to take this expression, vary H with upper indices with respect to H of lower indices, vary the determinant of H respect to H. It takes a little bit of work. You can find the details in Paul Chinsky, or you can actually do them. I think you'll do them as an exercise almost for sure.
You did it yesterday.
You did it yesterday, that's right. So what am I? Okay, so you already know that this goes there. Now, of course, this metric is not quadratic. This action is not quadratic in the metric. You might wonder if you'll be able to get rid of the metric in the same way as you did here by gauge fixing it. And here you might get in a little bit of trouble because the metric has 3 degrees of freedom. It's a symmetric matrix with 3 and with 2 by 2 symmetric matrix. But there are only 2 diffeomorphisms, degree of freedom. Right, these 2 arbitrary functions. So in general, you cannot gauge the symmetric completely. Rather, if you use diffeomorphisms, you can take any metric and bring it to a diagonal form. Okay, so you can say that HAB can be brought to a canonical form, e to the phi delta AB. So you cannot set the metric to 1, but you can set the metric to 1 up to an overall scale, at least locally on your surface. So you may worry that even if I do this, I will still end up with an action which has some horrible non-polynomial dependence on this thing called the conformal factor. But now some magic happens. The magic is that this action is not only diffeomorphism invariant, it's also Weyl invariant. So if you take this action and you multiply your metric by an arbitrary function, you get this, the action does not change. What's happening is that when you rescale H, AB, sorry, lower indices, then square root of the determinant also rescales by e to the f, but this scales by e to the f inverse. So this action is the magical property of being Weyl invariant. This is called the Weyl transformation. So that means that if you allow yourself to extend our gauge symmetry from just diffeomorphisms to diffeomorphism times Weyl, then we will be able to get rid of the metric completely. Actually, we do have to do so because of this, you see that if you start with the path integral over the metric and you gauge fix it, you'll end up with a path integral over phi, except that the action does not depend on phi. So your path integral will have a big overall factor, which is the area of all possible rescaling, the volume of all possible rescalings, which is just an overall factor in front of your path integral. And you can just drop it.
One question. The H is the metric on the worksheet.
On the worksheet, that's
and
correct.
The signature of that metric?
The signature actually does not matter in the sense that, well, okay. This is a very nice question. Most of the calculation we'll do will use Euclidean signature on the worksheet. And this might bother you.
No, I mean...
It should bother you, because after all, this worksheet is moving in space-time, the induced metric is not Euclidean. Okay. Actually, you can follow this problem all the way to quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, you might also wonder if you should use a Zwinger parameter, which is... what's the natural signature on the Zwinger parameter? Here, I did an integral... from 0 to infinity of e to the l b squared. But in many ways, it's more natural to have an integral of e to the I b squared l integrated from 0 to infinity. Now, if I were doing Euclidean quantum field theory, I would just use a Euclidean Zwinger parameter. Of course, we typically want to do Lorentzian quantum field theory. Lorentzian quantum field theory has all sorts of interesting conventions we need to keep track of, such as the I epsilon prescriptions. The I epsilon prescription, those are very important to get the right answers out of Feynman integrals. But a way to understand those high epsilon prescriptions is that all the integrals you do in Lorentzian signature are analytic continuations from Euclidean signature rotating in a specific direction. So all of this is to say that once you get to the final answer for the string theory amplitude that you computed using the Euclidean metric, you will be able to ask questions about, is there an analytic continuation of the whatever integrals I'm doing, which is more appropriate for Lorentzian signatures? And indeed, that weak rotation will be a way to account for the I epsilon prescription of the of the string theory calculations. So the string theory calculations also have some I epsilon prescriptions implicit or explicit in them. Depending on how this you do the calculations, you can hide these physical prescriptions under the carpet and say just do something that works and say it works because it works. Or you can do it more carefully, keeping track of all these I epsilons. In the textbooks, typically you do not see the careful keeping track of the I epsilon prescriptions. And people were quite cavalier about it for a while. But there have been recent papers by Wittem which fix all of these little all these little matters. So yes, so the correct answer to say is that yes, indeed, you could use path integral over Lorentzian metrics. Perhaps even better to think about a path integral over a complexified matrix. And then you sort of need to pick your integration contour. You should have an integration contour on a Lorentzian matrix, but you can deform it to run close to Euclidean metrics, or you can deform it to Euclidean metrics. Or perhaps better to say that the path integral Lorentzian matrix, which keeps track of I epsilon prescriptions, can be deformed to the path integral of a Euclidean matrix.
Yeah, what caught my attention is that we started with the Lorentzian metric there. I guess that at some point we started working with Euclidean, but for somewhat that.
Yeah, so there is always an implicit or explicit step where Lorentzian calculations with correct epsilon prescriptions are brought to the Euclidean for simplicity. But we, with some luck, we will encounter a place where we can show this when we actually do a calculation to the very end. Okay. So the proposal is to define our amplitude as a path integral over the embeddings, a path integral over the metric, with a gauge symmetry, which is diffeomorphisms times Weyl, and the action which is Weyl and diffeomorphism invariant. Now, to give meaning to this path integral, we will gauge fix, because we want to have something which is nice and quadratic, want to get rid of the metric. I had to start erasing some things. I erased the thing that I wanted to keep. So in the case of particles, gauge fixing allows us to replace the integral over matrix modulo diffeomorphisms as an integral over some gauge invariant quantities, which parameterize the actual invariant data of the metric. In a similar way, the integral over matrix in the worksheet divided by diffeomorphisms times Weyl can be rewritten as an integral over some degree of freedom, some degrees of freedom analogous to L. I will discuss it at the end of the lecture if I have time. So these degrees of freedom sort of parameterize the choices of representatives of a metric modulo violent diffeomorphisms. Because although locally you can make your metric trivial, you can never do so globally. After all, this manifold is not a flat plane, so I shouldn't be able to make the metric of this manifold flat everywhere. What you can do is you can do it in patches and then assemble the patches together, and there is a little bit of freedom left, a little bit of information left on how the patches are glued together. This information is something is called the complex structure. I'll say later why. But anyway, so you can say that for every possible choice of this piece of information, you have some representative metric. Which can be taken locally to be flat, but not globally. And so our path integral goes from here to an integral over x, an integral over these degrees of freedom, finite set of degrees of freedom of the metric, a finite integral, and a path integral over the x's, of e to the s of x with a metric, with a fixed metric depending on lambda. So we reduce this complicated integral to two steps. First, I do a path integral over these fields with a quadratic action. Now, these are just scalar fields on the worksheet. The simplest possible thing. The only non-trivial part is that it's a worksheet which is equipped with a non-trivial metric. So I need to learn how to do calculations on a worksheet on a two-dimensional surface. After I do this calculation on the two-dimensional surface, I integrate over the space of complex structures of the surface. This is a finite dimensional integral. And this is my answer. So this part of the finite integral corresponds to the integral of the path integral over the embedding coordinates, and this corresponds to this integral on the word line on the Schwinger parameters. Now, I've glissed over an important subtlety. So I said the action is while invariant, so we can treat while symmetry as a gauge symmetry. What I should have really said is, if the action is while invariant and the quantum theory is while invariant, then I can treat while invariance as a gauge symmetry. In other words, a path integral has two ingredients, as an action and a measure. And you need to make sure that the measure is invariant under a symmetry, not just the action. So classical symmetries do not always survive quantization. There is something called anomalies, which can obstruct the survival of a symmetry. If you have a symmetry and you can regularize your path integral in a way that preserves the symmetry, then you can be confident the symmetry survives. I don't know, if you have a quantum field theory, you give a lattice description of the quantum field theory, and you have some the symmetry which acts on each individual degree of freedom on the lattice, then you can be confident that the symmetry is actually a symmetry. But sometimes you cannot. Sometimes there is just no regularization which preserves the symmetry you're interested in. So you need to make sure that if you change regularization, which means that when you act with a symmetry on your path integral, you change the regularization, so you might be changing the answer. Now, a symmetry like diffeomorphism invariance is usually quite safe. Why? Because when you regularize your path integral, you typically do things like making a lattice, or separating operators by a little bit, or cutting off your momentum modes, putting a cutoff on a momentum mode. All of these operations can be done in a way which only cares about distances in space-time, actual distances, rather than coordinate-dependent things. So you could say, OK, I make my lattice, and I decide the distance between two points is determined by the actual distance controlled by the metric. So if you have a metric and some degrees of freedom, you can always regularize things in a way that preserves you from morphism invariance. Just by defining the cutoff in terms of the physical length. On the other hand, wild transformations change the physical length. So it's pretty clear that if you pick some cutoff on the table, and you do a conformal transformation changing the definition of length, your cutoff will change. Now we'll have a cutoff which is position dependent and changes from point to point and is different from the original one. This might give you a different answer. So wild symmetry can be broken by quantization. We will discuss anomalies in detail in another lecture. We'll see that the obstruction to anomalies are typically a finite set of pieces of information. So a set of numbers that tell you if the anomaly is there or not. For wild symmetry, there is one number. If the number is zero, the symmetry is preserved. If the number is non-zero, the symmetry is broken. Every piece of your measure contributes something to the number. The integral of the metric contributes minus 26 to the number. Maybe I should write somewhere else. So the number is called central charge, usually. So the central charge that comes from the integral over the metric is minus 26. The central charge that comes from the integral over a single space-time coordinate is 1. So if you want this number to cancel, you better have 26 dimensions in space-time. So this string theory, which is called bosonic string, naturally moves in a 26-dimensional space-time. So a theory for which this number cancels is called the critical string. Of course, you could complain and say, well, what if I don't put that number of coordinates? What if I do a non-critical string? That is fine. You can do so. If you do that, it means that if I do a wild transformation, this action doesn't change. The measure will change. So if I write the path integral from some metric, and then I do a wild transformation, I get a path integral which looks almost the same, but has an extra function of the conformal factor in front. So for a non-critical string, you end up with some integral which has the action the original action plus an extra piece, which was computed by Polyakov. And by staring at this long enough, you can convince yourself that you actually can build a critical string which just looks like that. So considering non-critical strings actually does not add any information. This conformal factor basically behaves like a new direction in which the worksheet can move. It's a ugly direction. It has a potential. It breaks Lorentz symmetry. But in principle, it's there. Meaning, doing non-critical string does not add anything new. You can write critical strings which have some fancy direction, which give you the same answer as a non-critical string would have. So we're not going to lose any generality by considering critical strings. And from now on, in the rest of the lectures, we'll never mention non-critical strings again. How much time can I go?
Do they have a class?
No, that's right. Okay, so I wanted to discuss conformal. I wanted to discuss what these degrees of freedom are, but I'll do it at the beginning of the next lecture. See you.